I think we should get started here. Okay. Good evening, everybody. We continue our tour of our home, and we finished the bedroom for the most part. For the most part. You see, the truth of the matter is tonight's topic is really an extension of it. What I mean by that is that we talked about the relationship between the husband and the wife. We talked about the physical intimacy, and we talked about the concept of Taras and Mishpacha, family purity, and the mikvah, and all of that. The obvious next step for me was that we create children. There is a mitzvah in the Torah. In fact, it is the very first commandment in the Torah, Pru Urvu, be fruitful and multiply, to have children. That is the first one. Jokingly, I'm sure it meant it, the person who said it to me meant it jokingly, but when we had our sixth child, wanted to know if I was ever going to turn the page or am I stuck on page one in the Torah? And you know, like there's a whole book out there, Tachman. Why are you stuck on page one? But it is the very first commandment in the Torah. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about this mitzvah. And obviously, I will also incorporate as part of our conversation, because many of you have unique circumstances in terms of not having biological children, and we will talk about that. But from a purely halachic, a purely Jewish law perspective, how many children does one need to have to fulfill this mitzvah? One, six, 15? Well, it's not a simple answer if you were at the time of the Mishnah. In the time of the Mishnah, there was great debate about this, and there's two major opinions. I'm not going to go into the depth of it because at the end of the day, we rule like one opinion, and that the opinion of Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel, the house of Hillel, the great Hillel that were famous throughout history, that we quote many of his sayings in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers. Famously, Hillel said, "Don't do unto your friend what you wouldn't want done to you." This is the great Hillel. Hillel ruled, and his disciples, that you need one boy and one girl. That's the bare minimum. One boy and one girl who have the capability themselves of having one boy and one girl. That's it. That's what the bare basic mitzvah requires. What is that based on? Why one boy and one girl? Well, one.
Replace yourself.
Okay, you're true, but it takes it even a step further. The very first creation that God created was a man and a woman, one and one. From the very beginning of creation, this was how God created the universe, with one male and one female. That is the requirement. That was the starting point. However, I would point out that there is a general mitzvah to populate the earth. Now it's true. Again, for one, just to get a check in the checkbox of what's required for the mitzvah. For example, if we talk about the mitzvah of eating matzah on Passover night at the Seder, there's a minimum requirement of how much matzah, how much maror, how much wine. It's not just you take a sip of wine. There's a certain amount you have to drink. What's the bare minimum? So when it comes to the mitzvah of having children, it's one boy and one girl, but there's a general mitzvah to populate the earth with people. Why is that? So one source is that the actual in the prophet Isaiah, in Yeshaya, it talks about that Hashem desires that the world not be desolate. God wants the world to have people. It's not the analogy that I saw it brought down is that if you are hosting a party, all of us have at one point or another have hosted a party. And there is nothing worse than hosting that party and very few, if anybody, shows up. Well, in all honesty, God is the host of this party called the world. And God wants people at the party. He doesn't want just a handful of us. He wants to have people. Ultimately, these people will all enjoy the party, be a part of the mission of what it is we're here to accomplish. But you want to make sure that God has as many guests as possible. That is one of the sources as to why people have many, many children. I wasn't that long ago. I don't think we use the terminology, but I'm curious how many of you have remembered that we talk about dinks. Dinks, D-I-N-K. Oh, Liz is shaking her head. Anybody else? Dinks. There were different texts. You know, you would look at it from different perspectives. You'd have people who are D-I-N-K, double income, no kids. Dink. They have a totally different perspective on life. They're looking at the mentality that life is a massive picnic and children are raining on their picnic because they want to enjoy life. They just want to have fun. And therefore, they have this great picnic planned. And gosh darn it, the children are eating into our picnic and it's raining on our parade. The Torah obviously does not look at children in that perspective. Not at all. Children are an inheritance, a gift from God. The Talmud phrases it so perfectly. And I say it, you know, with a smile on my face. How many partners are there in the creation of a child? Most of us would say two. You have the male and the female.
Right.
Each one is giving, you know, their contribution to the formation of the child. And then if I go ahead and I tell you, oh, by the way, there's a third partner there in the bedroom. And you're like, excuse me? I'm sorry. That's very inappropriate, Rabbi. But the answer is God is there. And God also has a contribution. It's called the soul. God also has a contribution in this process of forming and creating a child. So if you think about it, the mitzvah of having a child is basically partnering with God. If I told you, you know, I'm a venture capitalist and I want to invest in futures, this is it. Well, this is like a corporate venture with God. You're investing in the futures, i.e., of what these children are going to grow up and be productive members of society that God is going to be pleased with. So if I have the option to invest with God more than just one or two, if I can be a corporate partner with God on three or four or more, why not? It's a great investment for the future. That's the perspective about the beauty of having children. Now, technically speaking, we know that there are certain mitzvos that are incumbent upon both men and women, both male and female. And there are certain mitzvos that are unique, one and not the other necessarily. For example, the mitzvah technically speaking, any positive time-bound mitzvah, that means there's a specific time to fulfill it, to do it, and again, it's positive mitzvah. For example, hearing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, eating matzah at the Seder, shaking a lulav and etrog on the holiday of Sukkot. Those are positive commandments that are specifically performed at a time, specific time. If I shake a lulav and etrog today, it's a nice thing, but I got zero mitzvah out of it, zero. And I can have the loftiest, most spiritual thoughts in my head. It's absolutely worthless as far as a mitzvah. Similarly, technically speaking, any positive time-bound mitzvah, women are exempt. Women are not obligated to fulfill. So yes, you're looking at me and you're like, Rabbi, why didn't you tell me this 5.5 weeks ago that I didn't have to eat the matzah? It just destroys my digestive system. Why couldn't you tell me this last time? Well, you're not off the hook. That is not a great example because technically you should be exempt. However, the Torah makes the point that the ones who are obligated in the negative commandment of not eating chametz, of not eating leavened bread, have also the mitzvah positive to eat matzah. So while if in a vacuum, you could have theoretically been exempt because it is a positive time-bound mitzvah, that is tied directly to the negative commandment of not eating chametz, which you are obligated in. If you're obligated not to eat chametz, you are obligated to eat matzah. So while it's a good example, it's really not. Hearing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a better example. You heard it from me first. Ladies, you are not obligated. You are not obligated to hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It is a time-bound positive commandment. However, you're going to ask me, should I? Is it a good thing to do? Should I work really hard to go because it really becomes part of my service and getting into the mood of high holidays? The answer is yes, 100%. No reason not to. Go do it. But you are technically exempt. So now, how about this mitzvah of having children? It is a positive commandment, correct? It's not a negative commandment. It's a positive to have children, be fruitful and multiply. But is it a time-bound mitzvah? Is there a specific time? Is it only by night, not by day? Is it only on Fridays, not on Tuesdays? The answer is no. It is not a time-bound mitzvah. It's not. Yet, if you look in the Code of Jewish Law, it says outright, women are not obligated in this mitzvah. Strange. Why? It's not a positive time-bound mitzvah. Obviously, they're needed. You know, it takes two to tango. Can't have, without the ladies, the men are having, I'll tell you exactly, to the exact number of children that the men will have without the ladies. I'm not even estimating. The answer is zero. Right? So, yeah, okay. So it's very nice that they're technically exempt. Obviously, they're needed. But why? Why would women be exempt from this? So I found a beautiful insight. We very strongly believe that the Torah is there to benefit us. It's there to guide us so that we can live the most beneficial life we possibly can. The Torah would not ask of us something that is either impossible to do, or is a detriment to ourselves, or is harmful to ourselves. How bad would it be if there was a mitzvah in the Torah, you are to drink, smoke, and have, I mean, that would be a terrible Torah, right? Because those are things that are harmful to a person. So the Torah's ways are ways of pleasantness. Says the great Meshech Chachma, Rav Meir Simcha from Divinsk. He says the following suggestion. He says, because childbearing is potentially life-threatening. It's dangerous. A woman who has a child does put their life in jeopardy. There is a certain danger. In fact, we actually do a special prayer if you know somebody who is in labor or whatever. Yeah, because we need to ask for special mercy. The woman is in more grave danger than not childbearing. Therefore, the Torah cannot obligate a woman to put themselves in danger, because that's not the ways of the Torah. So yeah, obviously it's needed. And thank God, God implanted in most women this innate desire to have a child. There's a natural love that a woman has. They want to give to a child and nurture a child. Those are inborn to help the process. But the Torah can't demand of you something that would put you in danger. Therefore, he suggests that's the reason why they're not obligated, even though technically there's no reason they shouldn't be. It's not a positive time-bound one. But that is the fact. Now, what about adopting, right? We're talking about where a woman naturally has a child, gives birth to a child. Can one fulfill the mitzvah by adopting a child or raising a child? Many, many, many authorities are of the opinion that the answer is unequivocally yes. Not even a question. Why? What's the rationale? The Torah actually, if you want to look at it from a purely technical standpoint, they did not bear that child. The mitzvah is be fruitful and multiply. Well, technically through adoption, you didn't. No. You have to know a piece of Talmud that is so beautiful. The Talmud says, one who raises another's child is as if, listen to the words, is as if given birth to that child. The Torah holds in such high esteem somebody who raises a child with a sense of morality, with an ideal of spirituality, with Torah values. The Torah says it's as if you bore that child yourself. Well, if that's the terminology that's used, then yes, adopting and raising a child is as if you bore that child. Boom, there you go. That's the mitzvah of be fruitful and multiply. I'll show you how far it goes. How about somebody who was adopted, and then that parent, right, the one who raised them, while not a biological parent, when that parent passes away, does that child have an obligation to do the laws of mourning? Shiva, yeah. Kaddish, tear their clothing, bury? The answer is yes, absolutely, because it's as if the parent bore that child. So yes, those of you who've had the ability to adopt a child, you have fulfilled that mitzvah. That is correct. There are commentaries that take it further and say it doesn't even have to be adoption. Even helping to facilitate others getting married, marrying off and helping orphans get married. You are stepping in as a parent to help that child. Yeah, that is essentially what the Torah wants from this mitzvah. So just want to make sure that anytime I'm talking about, you know, and you had a child and you birthed a child, I'm not differentiating between biologically having a child or adopting and raising a child. I'm not differentiating. Okay? My question to you now is, okay, so there's a mitzvah in the Torah to have children. Does that mean to suggest that birth control is against the Torah? Well, you say to me, Rabbi, you know, birth control, you're interfering with the potential to have a child. So I'm not gonna get into all the details. It is an extremely complex question. I'm gonna share with you some factors that play in. Let's start with the obvious. The obvious is that there's a reason to say that birth control should be forbidden because we have a mitzvah in the Torah to have children. Does that mean every time a man and a woman have intimacy that a child is created? No, we know that. It's not given every single time. Not, right? Most of the time, it actually does not create a child. Regardless of birth control, it's not every night. There are some that literally it's every year they have a child. That's an amazing system between the two of them. But most people do not have a child every single time they're intimate. It just doesn't go that way. So if I go ahead and I take birth control, theoretically, then I should be going against what the Torah wants to create children. However, as I said before, the Torah's ways are ways of pleasantry. They're not there to make our lives difficult and miserable. That's not what it's all about. If, let's say, right, as is often the case, after having a child, there's a physical burden that now is incumbent upon mother and father. They have now, they're exhausted, right? Physical well-being, emotional well-being. There are many ladies who suffer after having a child with some level of postpartum depression. That is a real thing. Those are real considerations. Can, if you want to know the bottom line, the answer is yes. There are circumstances where birth control is not only permissible, but is encouraged. You have to know the circumstances. And you can ask me all the questions you want. I won't be able to answer it because each one is unique. The factors to take into consideration are physical, emotional, I'll say financial, but I'm wary to just give a blanket rule of, yeah, you know, it's hard. It costs a lot of money to have kids. That's not a valid excuse. That's really not. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, right? But is it a factor for a period of time? Yes. Yes. If it is an emotion, there's a difference in Jewish law and the way I received this guidance from my teachers. And that is there's a difference between child, let's say, number one and number two versus child number five and number six. The parents are older. Their financial responsibilities are much greater at that point. It's taken its toll physically. It's taken its toll emotionally. A parent, you know, a parents who come to the rabbi and they say, listen, we've already had five children and we had a boy and a girl. So we fulfilled the mitzvah. Let's just get that out of the way, right? We've had five and we're nervous about having another child. We're just not in a state of mind to have yet another child. The rabbi will take that into consideration and probably would give them some dispensation for a period of time. Not at, you know, what's the word? Infinite, you know, for infinite amount of time. They'll give it a guidance. They'll say, okay, let's review this in 6 months. How are we doing in 6 months? I'm not saying you have to do it again in 6 months, but let's reevaluate. So it's factors, how long, and let's be honest, there's different kinds of birth control. All of this are factors in terms of whether the rabbi will give guidance on that or not within Jewish law. There's a difference, and I'll tell you where this is coming from. Some of you may not be familiar. There is a prohibition in the Torah of wasting seed, right? For a man to waste his seed is something that the Torah is very much against. So factoring that into it, there's a difference between having a normal, and again, I apologize if it's too graphic, but I want you to understand, a male and a female who have the correct intimate relationship and they are physically doing the activity, create a child, but the seed doesn't take hold of the egg, that's fine. That's fine. But to go ahead and not allow the seed to enter into the woman, that's not the norm. So I'll differentiate between a woman using a diaphragm, for example, or a woman who's taking a birth control pill that doesn't allow the egg to come out, but they have the intimacy, the physical act, as if it were normal, the regular way it's done. He gives his contribution and there everyone is. That is much better than using a condom, for example. There are differences within Jewish law. So I'm not going to tell you here all the details in terms of birth control, but I want to clear a myth. There seems to be a myth that within the Orthodox world, they don't allow birth control. And I'm here to tell you on record, that is not true. That is not true. It depends on so many factors, but it is a legitimate possibility given the right circumstances. Does that mean willy-nilly you just, well, you said you can use birth control. I didn't say that. I didn't say it outright. I'm saying there are cases and circumstances that would allow it, that would not allow it. What type of birth control, when, how, all these different factors. Similarly, this begs the question now in terms of abortion. Once you have the child formed, and if you think I'm going to touch this with a 10-foot pole, you're out of your mind. I am not going down that road because it is even more complex than the birth control issue. Are there circumstances, and I'll say it very clearly, this is as far as I'll go with it, and I'll tell you a story. Everybody puts it into two camps. You're either pro-life or you're pro-choice. The Torah is neither. Or if you want, the Torah is both. How's that? Everybody smiles then. The Torah is both. There is a general perspective that we don't abort. However, there are circumstances that do warrant aborting the baby, aborting the fetus. And you know, ask me all the details. How far along? This semester, that semester, within 40 days, third year, not going there. I just want to make it clear. We are not exclusively pro-life and we are not exclusively pro-choice. There are circumstances where abortion is permitted. It has to be done. That's fine. I see some of you have like a, you want more. Is there a specific, no, I want to clarify. Is there something specific that's bothering you about it?
This isn't really specific about bothering me, but as another clarification, how about for like fertility treatments and such?
Fertility treatments are allowed. Again, again, everything I'm telling you have guidelines, have you know, certain restrictions. It's not carte blanche. The same way birth control and abortion are not cut and dry, one answer fits it all. The answer is the same with fertility treatments. There has been an amazing amount of advancement when it comes to infertility treatments or fertility treatments that are astounding, that are not only acceptable, but in many cases are encouraged. There is definitely more than just room to allow it. It's really a good thing. It's a wonderful thing that if that can work for various couples, for whatever the reason, fertility treatments are an excellent, excellent possibility.
And not to go too far down that road, but how about couples that you, in a sense, you know, with the donated egg, donated sperm, surrogates, those sort of things?
Correct. Those are factors within it. And I can't answer there. Again, it's not a cut and dry yes, no, no, yes. It really depends on circumstances. And this is really, I debated whether I should even bring this up, but I felt it was important that you understand that on these two, three issues, which are very big, complex issues, the Torah has what to say within boundaries, within guidelines. Are they a simple solution? No, they're not. It is very complex in halacha, very complex, and a very competent. I would not feel comfortable answering a question like that. That's not my field of expertise. I would take it to my Rebbe. I would take it to my teacher, my mentor, who is extremely knowledgeable in this area.
Right. No, I wasn't asking for real specifics, just if it was allowed or not allowed at any.
Yeah, so the answer is with it, yes and no. It depends.
Not, sure.
Okay. Not everything that you're going to present in terms of surrogacy is permitted. Are there some? Perhaps yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sharon, no, wait. Sharon, you had a question?
Yeah.
No? Okay, Susan.
Are there any thing that would require in any of these areas a Beit Din to be convened to give an opinion on?
No.
Just one's rap.
You don't need a court to adjudicate that case. This is somebody, a rabbinic authority who is knowledgeable in this area, and that's an important term. Knowledgeable in this area. I mean, I remember I was relatively newly married. Maybe I was married 2 years. Maybe I had the good fortune of studying with my Rebbe, with, you know, on topics related to this. And he, I mean, I was just blown away by his medical knowledge. Forget the Torah knowledge, but he had been in contact with experts in the field about the physiology, the anatomy. Like, he knew all these things and he knew procedures. I had never heard these terms before, but he was like totally, and he always talks to doctors. What's the latest? There's a new science that's come out. He's already on it and has the knowledge. And then he has the ability to use what he knows are the Torah guidelines and the Torah principles and apply it. That's above my pay grade, significantly above, way above me. It's not my field of expertise. So a rabbinic authority that knows their information, not just the Torah aspect, but the medical knowledge, that's somebody who can give guidance. You don't need a court for that. You don't need a Beit Din for that. Okay. If you thought this was hard, I'm just getting warmed up, because having a child is only the first, I'll say half, but it's really less than that. In the aggregate, it's a tiny piece of this mitzvah. Why? Let's go back to the source. What is the source for this mitzvah? To have children? Because God said, "Gru uravu, be fruitful and multiply, and conquer the earth, and right, take domain, etc." Be fruitful and multiply. Isn't that the same thing twice? Fruitful is to multiply. You have many, many fruits. Your children are your fruit. You know, you're the tree and you're producing the next fruit. So, okay, either say be fruitful, in which case I'd understand, or say multiply. What is fruitful and multiply? As they often say, it's the Department of Redundancy Department. Right? What's up with that? So Rav Shamshin Rafael Hirsch, one of my favorites, you know, he asked this question and he says, in truth be told, he doesn't say it this way, but especially given the fact that we know to fulfill this mitzvah, you only need one boy and one girl, right? That's not multiplying. That's adding. That's addition. It doesn't even reach the category of multiplication yet. Say be fruitful and add. Okay, maybe, maybe. But fruitful and multiply sounds like, you know, it's 100 kids or bust. That's your choice. Multiply. So he says like this. He says, such a beautiful idea. He says, what does it mean to multiply? It means to multiply yourself. You need to replicate yourself. Now, I want to be very careful here. Replicating yourself is not limited to just physical. We all know how genetics work, right? For better or worse, some of my children are carbon copies of their father, literally. Moshe, my son, God bless him. He goes, it's like, yeah, you're Rabbi T's kid. No question about that. And I have others that look like me. Thank God others look like my wife's side. Thank God. But Rav Hirsch writes that the idea of replicating ourselves is not just physical, but all of our spiritual, our intellectual, our morals, whatever it is that we need to replicate in our children. I'll be very simple. The mitzvah of having children is a one-time event. The rest of your life, you are fulfilling the other part of the mitzvah, and that is nurturing those children, guiding them, giving them the support they need so that those values you hold dear are replicated in them. You are passing down the Mesorah. You're passing down the tradition. You are giving that guidance and development. He writes, Rav Hirsch writes, that the word revu, right, that second half, be fruitful and multiply, the word revu is related to the word roveh, which means it's a term that's used that when you shoot a bow and arrow, the guidance you give to the arrow through the bow, that's called roveh kashas, aiming the bow. That's really what it is. Peru is literally just creating a fruit. For the gentlemen, that's a one-time event. For the ladies, it's 9 months, but that's it. Then you have a lifetime of guiding. Yeah, you thought that having children was the hard part. Oh, no, 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 no. It's the raising and educating and guiding our children for the rest of our lives. Folks, it never ends. That mitzvah is not over when they graduate. It's not over when they get married. It's not over, period. Fact. Perhaps with this, I finally understood, you know, the Talmud says that after we pass from this world, we are asked a series of questions about what we've accomplished in our life. One's about being honest in business. We took that seriously. If we put our faith in God, did we believe that the Mashiach is going to come? Like all various questions that are asked. The third of the six questions we're asked after death is, did you fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Uravu? And it always bothered me. What does that mean? Look, God, you don't have eyes to see. Did I or did I not raise children? Did I or did I not have children? Why is that a question? If you come to me and you say at the end of my life, and I come before God, a person comes before God and he says, Did you act honestly in business? Okay. Obviously, God knows the answer, but that's a question. That's a moral question. Did I stick to my principles? Was I very fastidious in making sure that I didn't cheat anybody, even unwillingly? Okay, that's a question that I have to answer. Did I anticipate and look forward to the Mashiach coming? Okay, that's a question that I have to answer. But whether I had children or didn't have children, dude, that's a simple question. Like, look, see. You see, if you understand Rav Hirsch now, that question that we're asked is not, did you physically have children? Kru Uravu, did you have and raise children properly? That's a whole different ball game. That's a life's work. That's a whole lifetime of work. This is what is being asked of us. Did we fulfill our obligation of not just having them, but raising and nurturing them? It's a critical priority in life. Why do I say that? Let's fast forward to a story in the Torah. The Torah has a story about the Jewish people towards the end of their 40-year sojourn in the desert. The time has finally come. It's on the horizon that they're going to cross over the Jordan River and they're going to enter the land of Israel. Okay. Moshe is going to pass away and Yehoshua is going to lead them into the promised land. What happens? The Torah says that as they were going through what we call modern day Jordan to cross over the Jordan River into Israel, there were two tribes that had done extremely well with flock. They had cattle and flock, and they saw the great grazing land over on the Transjordan side, and they wanted to stay. So they came to Moshe, and they said, we would like to stay so that we can have grazing land, and we will build pens, corrals for our animals, and homes for our children and our wives, but we want to stay. Moshe's response was a harsh rebuke on two areas. They made two fatal flaws in their argument. Number one is that they're saying that they don't want to come and join their brothers and sisters in conquering the land of Israel. It's going to put a damper. It's going to demoralize the other tribes, thinking, oh, great. As it is, it's hard enough that we're going to have to conquer the seven nations that are living there. And yes, we know God's going to help us. But two of those tribes are cutting out on us. It's going to demoralize the troops. Bad choice. You've got to come fight with us. If afterwards you want to go back and that's where you want to settle, we can work it out. But you have to come and join the fight so that all of us as one nation are fighting this battle. That's the first rebuke he gives them. And then he turns to them and he says, I can't believe that you went ahead in your prioritizing of why you want to stay. You put your animals before your kids. You said you want to build pens and corrals for your animals, for your flock, and homes for your children and family. Wrong. Moshe rebukes them and he says, no, never, ever, ever put anything above your children. Not your livestock, not your cattle, not your career, not anything. Your children are your most important possession. Nothing. Nothing goes ahead of them. Yes, Jewish education is extremely expensive. Right? It is. It's a fact. Jewish education. I think to myself, man, if Mrs. T and I didn't have to spend the money on private school tuition, wow. That would have been cool. However, I remember a bumper sticker and it had nothing to do with Jewish education. It just said, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Brilliant, brilliant bumper sticker. Now, how much more so is that true when it comes to Jewish education? Because their entire spiritual, moral fabric is dependent on it. The continuation of what we hold as our dear value system is critically important. And if we don't pass that down to our children, then no matter how many great experiences we gave them in life and how many wonderful vacations and cars and all these things, they're all wonderful things, but not at the cost of Jewish education. It can't be. Yeah, it is expensive, but that's what I have my money for. Do I have to forgo certain things? Yes, because there's only a certain amount of money to go around, but not at the cost for my children. That's a no. And this is what Moshe was telling these two tribes. If your main focus, the first words out of your mouth as to why you want to stay over there is because it's the best for your animals and you'll be able to really succeed with raising cattle, then you've made a tragic error. Instead of raising cattle, you need to raise children. Remember the comic strip Family Circus? Family Circle? What was it? Family Circle, I think, right?
Circle.
Great. It was such a great, I have it in my folder here. I used to do a class of once a week, we would analyze a comic strip. Hmm. Talk about whether that is or is not in line with the Torah value. Pretty cool idea. Maybe we'll do it one day. But I remember this vividly. It shows the kids playing in the backyard. And, you know, these couple of kids are riding, are sitting on the swing. And of course, as you swing, you're wearing out the dirt because you got to stop. And this one's going down the seesaw, down the slide, and again, wearing it out. And this one, they're throwing, you know, they're playing kickball. And basically the neighbor looks over and he says, don't you want, like, you know, don't you want to have beautiful grass? And the response was, we're raising children, not grass. That's not bad. You know, would I love to have a beautiful lawn? Yes, I would love to have it. But if I'm short $100 or I'm short $1,000 and I can only have, I'm going to put it towards my kids and do what I have to do for them. The grass? Okay. I'll put mulch down. It's cheaper. Okay. But this is the point. You know, you say to me, but are all kids destined to be so knowledgeable? They're not all going to be rabbis. I'm not suggesting that they all be rabbis. But do they have to be knowledgeable in Jewish law? Do they have to be knowledgeable of Jewish philosophy? Yes. There's not a Jew out there that shouldn't know the basic principles of Judaism. We expect when our kids come back from school, we expect them to have basic knowledge of American government, of history, of math, of science. There's basic curriculum that we expect. And if the school system doesn't provide that, we will yank them and put them in a school that does have it. We won't tolerate something like that. We would never put up. We would go in front of the Board of Education and we would fight like mad. Because this is critical for my child's education. They need to know. Our Jewish education is less than that? Can't be. It's our essence. It's who we are. We're not just Americans. We're not just human beings. We're Jews. And we have a Torah. We have a Jewish education. I'm preaching to the choir. I don't know. If anybody is listening to this at some future time, some anthropologist will find this tape. They'll know I was passionate about it. Okay. All kids have potential to be great, engaged Jews. No Jew is excluded from that. I may have shared this in the past. Here's a fascinating law. Again, I go back to what do we rule in terms of Jewish law? The law is that a Jewish child, an infant, should really not nurse from a non-Jewish woman. That's really the proper thing. The Jewish child should nurse from a Jewish mother, a Jewish woman. Okay? Now you say there are circumstances where that may not be feasible. Okay, I'll deal with that next. Where is the source for that law?
Moses.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Fred, with Moses. What's the story?
They had to bring in, they knew he was a Jewish baby, and they had to bring in a Jewish woman, and it just turned out to be his mother, you know.
Correct. I love what you say. It just turned out to be. Yeah. There's a master chess player above who's moving the pieces on the board.
Yeah.
But okay. The idea being that when they tried, when the daughter of Pharaoh took this young infant in, so clearly he needed to eat, So she tried. She tried the wet nurse. She tried this one, tried that one. And Moshe refused to nurse. And that's when she said, what do I do? What do I do? And of course, happened to be, the Miriam happens to come along at the on the seashore and say, I can get a Jewish, yeah, clearly it's a Jewish kid, I can get a Jewish wet nurse. Oh, would you please? That would be wonderful. And of course, she calls her mother and says, hey, mom, go nurse your son. Right? And so Moshe. That is the source that is cited as to why a Jewish child should only nurse from a Jewish woman. The great Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky asked a very simple question. What's the reason why Moshe wouldn't nurse? Why did God arrange it that Moshe wouldn't nurse from the Egyptian woman? Because the mouth that was going to speak directly, face to face, to use the terminology, with God, the way Moshe conversed with God is how you and I have a conversation. Just a friend, one-on-one kind of. So sure, somebody like Moshe, who was destined to be the one to speak with God directly, it would be inappropriate for him to nurse. You know, that mouth is so holy, it wouldn't be appropriate to nurse from a non-Jewish one. But what's that got to do with Jack Schwartz? What's it got to do with little Yankala? You know, little Yankel, he's growing up in, you know, Omaha, Nebraska. He's Jewish, but what's that got to do? He's not going to become the next Moses. This is what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky asked. Why would this be a Jewish law that applies to every single Jewish child? Reserve it for those who are destined to be Moses, to be the ones to talk to God straight. Answers Rav Moshe, this is a powerful lesson about the potential of every Jewish child. They could be great. They could be the next Moses. How do you know? Don't underestimate and don't undersell your child. This child has the potential to be great. All kids have the potential to be great. And therefore, we want to protect as much as we can. Now, are there circumstances where it can be? Yes. There are circumstances of where you need a wet nurse. And if there's no other Jewish one available, the halacha is, the law is that you can use a non-Jewish woman, but you should encourage her to not eat non-kosher food. Because as we know, the breast milk is formed out of what the woman eats. So therefore, if she at least is careful not to eat outright non-kosher, I'm not saying it has to be Chol of Yisrael and it has to be glatt kosher. It just shouldn't be non-kosher. That is it better than none, right? Than eating from a woman who eats non-kosher food. Okay. I want to show you just how far we have to be careful in terms of raising our children. And the same is true, by the way, for grandchildren, for many of us who are in that category. We still have a great impact on our children and our grandchildren. How careful we have to be with what we say and what we do around the kids. I want to tell you an amazing piece of Talmud. Listen to this story. Let me give you a little background. In the times of the temple, we know that it was the Kohanim, the priests, who were the representatives of the Jewish people that would do the service in the temple. They would be the ones to bring the communal offerings on our behalf, and they did the whole service. And it was just, you know, well, how did they determine what was the rotation as to which Kohen worked which day? You know, they didn't have Excel spreadsheets back then and didn't have, you know, email to disseminate this easily. So how did they do it? So I believe it was King Solomon. I forget if it was King Solomon or King David who came and devised of a system. He divided all the Kohanim, all of them, into 24 groups. 24 groups. They were known as a mishmar, mishmarot. 24 groups. And the job of that group of a Kohen, they would work a week at a time. So let's say, for argument's sake, Fred, you're a Kohen. Poof, you're now a Kohen. Okay? You're in group one. Poof, I'm a Kohen. I'm in group two. Okay? Fine. It's your week. Fred, group one is working the first week in June. That's your week, okay? That's your week. So all the coins, let's just, for argument's sake, I'm just going to make simple numbers here. Let's pretend there's a total of 24,000 coins. 24,000, make it simple. 1,000 coins per group, okay? I know it's late, and I know it's math, but that's relatively simple. 24,000 coins, 24 groups, that's 1,000 per group, okay? the 1,000 that are in Fred's group, 999 others, are going to come to the temple, come, and they're going to get ready to do their service. They're going to say, okay, we're 1,000, but I don't need 1,000 people working Sunday and 1,000 people working Monday and 1,000 people working Tuesday. What we'll do is we'll take the 1,000 and we're going to divide it by 6 so that one group will work. What's that, 160 something, 180 something? I don't know, whatever the number is. Okay. We'll work on Sunday. And the other 800 will be on call in case there's a big rush and there's a lot of Jews that came to the temple that day and they need more help to bring offerings. They're on call. Okay. And then Fred, let's say you're in group one, but you're day 3, you're Tuesday. Okay. So Fred, he's hanging out in Jerusalem. He's probably taking pictures and developing them, but that's what he does on Sunday and Monday. And Tuesday, you know, he has to be at the temple. So he's going to be there Tuesday, but he's on call in case fine. And that's the way it worked until Shabbos. Shabbos, there was so much more to do. All 1,000 worked on Shabbos. Okay, I'm giving you a basic overview here. Okay, the new group and the old group would change the guard on Shabbos. Okay, just make notes of all this. Okay, all of them would work if there was a holiday that week, because then it's all hands on deck. Okay, why am I telling you this? Because the Talmud tells the following story. A peculiar thing happened with one of these groups. Here's what it says. It happened once that Miriam, the daughter of a man named Bilgah, became an apostate from the Jewish faith. She gave up. She renounced her Judaism, and she went and married a military officer of the royal Greek rulers. When the Greeks entered the sanctuary during the story of Hanukkah, she walked right over to the Mizbeach, to the altar, and with her foot, her sandal, she kicked it. She kicked the altar and she said, "Wolf, wolf, you consume the money of the Jews, but you do not stand by them when they're in trouble. All you do is suck up their money. They give offerings and offerings on the altar and offerings. And here it is. We can just walk right in. Nobody to stop us. You're full of you know what." This is what she said. When the sages learned of the matter, they sent and they shut down that group's ring and they blocked up their cubbyhole. What ring? What cubbyhole? Now, let's go back to our groups. Fred is there working. Okay? Fred's there working, but Fred doesn't come without at least a backpack, something. He's got to have a change of clothes because when the Kohen is actually working, he has special garments he has to wear. He can't wear that, you know, walk from, you know, the great synagogue and walk all the way to the temple and you know, be wearing those. That's reserved for the temple. So you have to have some kind of cubby that he would keep his clothes in, or if he had medicine he needed, he had a cubby hole. That group would have, okay, this is Tuesday's group's cubby hole. Similarly, each group had their special table in terms of bringing the offerings, and they had to cut it open when they divided it up, and they would have a special ring, not one that they wore, but a metal ring to hold the animal's neck so that it wouldn't move during the slaughtering process. There were 24 rings, 24 tables, 24 of each of these, each one assigned to a group. This group, because of the story of this one girl named Miriam, the daughter of Bilgah, who messed up, the entire group's ring was closed and they had to borrow someone else's when they did their service. Their cubbyhole was closed and locked and they had to go borrow someone else's. They had to use someone else's. All of these things, they lost the privilege. Some say, fine, okay. The Talmud says, we understand that if you want to punish Miriam, she's the one. She left Judaism. She went ahead and had the chutzpah to speak with such derogatory terms against the altar and against God. Fine. She sinned. Punish her. But asks the Talmud, on account of her, because she sinned, we penalize the whole group? What do you want from them? What did they do wrong? Abaye says, yes. As the saying goes, The chatter of a child in the street is either from its father or from its mother. Where do kids pick up these ideas from? They pick it up very often from the home. They hear these things. If a child parrots certain ideologies, the kid's not sophisticated enough to know that stuff yet. And where did they get it? They heard it at home. I'll give you a terrible example. Terrible. Dad comes home from shul. Mom says to him, so what day, how was shul today? It was fine, but oh my God, they're having another building campaign. If I get asked one more time, they're killing me on this. Next week, father comes home. How was work today? Oh, it was brutal. I right in the middle of an important deal, I had to go daven. Right in the middle of everything, I had to daven mincha. And the next week, and every time, you know what the kid keeps hearing? The kid keeps hearing messages. He never said it. But what came across loud and clear is that Judaism is a pain in the behind. All they are doing is they're rubbing me for money. They're interfering with my having enjoyment of earning a living. Every time I turn around, there's another collector. You know what they're learning? They're learning it's hard to be a Jew. That's what they're learning. Never said it, but you pick up on it. Kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. The Talmud says that if she learned this concept, you know what? It's very likely that Miriam's father and or mother came home and said, oh my God, every time I turn around, I got to bring another offering in the temple. I did an Aveira. I did a sin. Oh, I got to bring a sin offering. Oh, now I got to turn around and oh my, it's a holiday. Now I got to bring another calf. Oh, wow. Now it's Pesach. I got to do a Pesach offering. I feel like I'm traveling to Jerusalem in the temple three times a week. Killing me. Kids, pick up on this. We have to be so, so careful. There's a great comic strip. Another one. I found it recently, so you'll forgive me. Where'd I put it? Come on. Hold on. Here it is. Sorry. Do you remember the comic strip For Better or Worse?
Here is your reminder. County Omar.
Okay, listen to this. It shows the little girl playing in a dollhouse. And she picks up one of the figures and says, look at your messy room. Next one. Eat your dinner. Don't play with it. Pick up your dishes. Don't expect me to clean up after you. No TV until you pick up all your toys. I said now, not later. Each one of these is a separate frame. Don't argue with me. You do have to take a bath tonight. The third to last frame shows the mother peeking in from the door. And the kid keeps going. Don't use so much shampoo. And then the kid realizes the mother's standing there and says, oh, were you listening to me, mommy? He says, no, April. I was unfortunately listening to me. Bam. That is what is at stake, ladies and gentlemen. Having children is easy. That's the easy part. Whether you physically have them or you adopt and raise them. The critical part is what do we do about nurturing them and guiding them? What we say and what we do. You know, it's almost Shavuos. It's almost the holiday of Shavuos. I want to finish up here. Right? I want to read you a Midrash. The Midrash makes it very clear. What is Shavuos? The holiday of Shavuos is what we commemorate the fact that we were given the Torah. God speaks the Ten Commandments to the entire Jewish nation, and he offers us the Torah. And we accept, and this forges our future. Listen to a beautiful Midrash. The Midrash says that when the Jewish people stood at Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, God said to them, I swear that I will give you the Torah. Just bring me good guarantors that will guarantee its survival, and I will give it to you. Think about it. God's greatest treasure, the Torah, he's willing to give us, but he says, I'm not an idiot. I want a guarantor. You want to go buy a house. You go to the bank for a loan. They want, you want a mortgage. I need to have some assurances. I need to have some, you know, I need to know some guarantor who's going to do this. What happens if you default on the loan? So God says the same thing. I want a good guarantor. Continues the Midrash. The Jewish people respond, Master of the universe, our ancestors will act as the guarantors for us. God says they're wonderful. The matriarchs, patriarchs, they're excellent, but not enough. They say, okay, let all of our prophets over the course of our history be our guarantors. The great righteous individuals. God says those are great also, but no dice. Finally, the Jewish people say, our children will be our guarantors. God answers, they are certainly fine guarantors, and because of them will I give you the Torah. For me, this midrash opened up an entirely different understanding. I always believed that the concept was we were given the Torah and we have an obligation. Our responsibility is to give it over to the next generation. But it really was mine. I got it. And now I have the job and the mission to give it over to the next generation, which is true. But what right do I have to have it in the first place? What right do I have to have Torah? It's only because it's guarantor, the children will get it. That's the only reason I have the right to it, is because I promised that I will give it, I'll give it to the next generation. If I'm not going to go ahead and give it to the next generation and inspire them, then I have no right to it either. That's a very powerful midrash. We are entitled to have the Torah because it's on condition that we will pass it down. We will transmit these values to the next generation. So what is this mitzvah of having children? Yeah, having them and then raising them. The raising them is significantly more time-consuming, more expensive, more exhausting than quote-unquote having the children. As difficult as that is. This is our responsibility, and it makes no difference what age we are, whether we're just starting out as a young married family, already we're already past that stage and we're up to children and grandchildren and maybe even great-grandchildren. We are still here. We are still in a position of influencing our descendants and guiding them with what is critically important. Do not underestimate and say, well, that's not where they are. They're not so religious. This has nothing to do with religiosity. This is the core of who we are as a people. Without Torah, we are nothing. We, not them, they for sure without Torah are doomed, but we are as well. It is our responsibility. This is what the mitzvah is demanding of us. Brew, be fruitful, have the children, but revu, guide them, multiply and replicate your value system. Make sure that they have that as well. That is really part and parcel of what this mitzvah is all about. Questions? It's a heavy topic. Sorry. Not really. How's it go? Hashtag sorry, not sorry. Yes, Fred.
It's not a question. It's a statement. And it's a shame because when our kids moved, when we moved here to Maryland, the children had been, the kids had been, two boys had been in a Jewish day school in Charlotte. So our first reaction was, let's enroll them in a Jewish school here. And we couldn't get them into the one in Rockville on Montrose because we, long story there. So we enrolled them in the Silver Spring, I guess it's yeshiva, really. It's an Orthodox.
The Hebrew Academy.
Okay. I was raised conservative. We had a conservative home. I mean, we are not a little lax about a lot of things, but I remember Stephen one day when I was asking him about school, and he said, Dad, it doesn't make sense. I learn what to do in school. I learn the prayers, whatever, but we don't do all of that here at home. And I realized at the time my thinking was, it's a school that's too, again, Orthodox, conservative, the difference. We're living a conservative, which means we follow the holidays, we follow things, but we don't keep the Sabbath. We it's some things yes, some things no, but they're being told strictly what the law is, what it
you,
is.
You face the challenge that everybody faces, and I don't think it's unique to Orthodox, conservative, reform. We all face that. None of us are perfect. None of us are doing everything, quote unquote, that we're supposed to be doing. And it is somewhat contradictory. We want them to learn it. We want them to understand it. And then we don't necessarily put it into practice.
Do what I say, not what I do, kind of thing, right?
It's a difficult challenge. It is. I don't have the answer to say, oh, you should have done this or you should have done that. That's easy to say, you know, 2020 hindsight, but whatever. The point is that what we have to do is to try to minimize that contradiction as much as possible. The same way, if I'm, forget Judaism. I mean, don't, but just for this example, right? If you want to teach your child, let's say your child is struggling with cheating, stealing, a petty theft, not, you know, God forbid something serious, right? But you notice, you know, that, you know, your wallet always seems to be a little lighter when they stay up late, you know, somehow it's a little lighter the next morning, just, you know, whatever, right? But if we're not careful about it, then we're giving them a mixed message, right? If I come home and I'm telling my wife about how I pulled this great shtick and I got this customer to pay extra because, you know, that was a good one, way to go, T, then you're reinforcing the message that it's okay, but don't do it. Here's another terrible example. Kid is working, you know, kid has trouble lying, and the father is berating the child. We don't lie. It's not appropriate. You have to tell the truth. And he's really giving it to the kid. And then the phone rings. And another kid picks up. And the kid picks up and says, Dad, you have a phone call. Who is it? It's Mr. So-and-so. Tell him I'm not home. What happened to that whole speech about not lying?
Yeah.
We all struggle with this. You know, you can't look back and say, well, if there's that. It's a struggle. And what we have to do is to set our kids up for success to the best of our ability. Will we fail in certain areas? Yes. We're human. We make mistakes. It's to be understood. But what the Torah is asking of us is the same way that we put in our energy, our effort, our finances, our focus, all of this for what we consider to be priorities in our life, the children and their education and their guidance has to be at the top of that list. Always. Whatever the capacity is. Doesn't make a difference where you are on the religious spectrum. That's what's being asked of us. And that's what we strive for. We all struggle with that. It's hard. This is the hardest job we ever have. Ever. It's the hardest job. Maybe that's why it's the very first mitzvah. We always think it's the first mitzvah because you got to do what you got to do. I think perhaps it's the first mitzvah because it's A1, priority number one, making sure that we are pru and revu, fruitful, but multiplying and making sure we're giving that guidance. Any other questions or comments, thoughts, ideas? Okay.
I just don't know if we can count the Omer while we're all here. Because you were just talking about it. That's okay.
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead. I haven't done it yet, so I do it with my wife. I haven't done it yet, but let me turn this off here. But okay, so next week, one second, we're on for next week, correct? I just want to make sure I got my dates right. The 24th. Yeah, we are on. So we're probably going to do a special on the holiday of Shavuos. I want to talk about that. And then I believe we made up that the 31st will be, at least for now, the last class. That may not work. Hold on. Hold on, hold on, hold on.